Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Sunday, July 26th, 2020. It's going to be a blistering hot day here in Nashville, and way too hot to be out in the garden. I continue to be inspired by the work of Dr. Henry Gates, the Harvard professor and host of public television's show Finding Your Roots. Through his genealogical investigations of prominent personalities, he demonstrates that genealogy study is not just about pedigree charts. People and families are necessarily intertwined with the events and places of their times. The ancestors of today's African Americans came to our shores involuntarily for the most part. And when you attempt to trace black family histories, you run smack dab into the institution of slavery. It can't be avoided. Our guest today, Tania Kuntz, has been involved in African American family history study for over 20 years. She presently serves as the president of the Nashville chapter of the African American Historical and Genealogical Society. Today, we talk about her journey studying her family roots, as well as her involvement in projects relating to black family history here in Middle Tennessee. And so I hope you will enjoy this interview with Tania Kuntz. Welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Well, thank you. I'm so delighted to have the invitation to join you today.
Well, this is going to be a lot of fun. As I said before we got on the air, I think you and I are kindred spirits. We're at least we share this particular hobby in common, for sure.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Tania, you are involved in so many things that relate to family history and genealogy, particularly involved with the study of African American origins.
Yes.
As we get started with these interviews, I always like to ask my guest, where are you from? How did you get interested in all this?
Well, yes, I'd be happy to share a bit about myself and how I got interested in exploring this topic. So I am from North Carolina. I was actually born in New York. Okay. But when I was just about 3 years old, my parents moved to North Carolina because it's where my father's family is from. He grew up in Eastern North Carolina.
Okay.
So we moved to the middle of the state, to the Greensboro area. So I grew up in Greensboro and Charlotte, spending some time in both of those cities. And went to college in Atlanta at Emory University.
Okay.
Then on to graduate school, UNC Chapel Hill, go Tar Heels. So
with a focus on library science.
Yes, at Chapel Hill, I did my master's degree in library and information science. Yes,
super.
And maybe we'll get to that later on in the show,
sure,
but it's had great synergy with what I do for my hobby. So I then went on to start my professional career. I started off in D.C. and then came to Nashville to become a member of the medical library at Vanderbilt. And then now I'm with the Center for Knowledge Management. Also
okay.
At the University.
At Vanderbilt. Okay.
At the medical center. Yeah.
So your involvement with family history in my book is an interest in cultural studies. And
yes.
And what fascinates you about that? What gets you?
Yeah. Well, so when I first got interested in my family history, I love sharing the story that it really, I saw interest kind of throughout the arc of my lifetime. So my first, I think, spark happened when I was about 9 years old. We had buried my aunt and we were at the family cemetery. And I look around and see all these headstones with the same last name as mine. And so I remember asking my father, who are all these people? They have their same last name. And so he was explaining to me that they were family members that passed away. So I remember, I think that was the first time I realized there were more relatives than just my grandparents, right? There were people who came before my grandparents. So that was when I was 9. And then when I was in college, I'd interviewed both of my grandmothers one summer. I don't remember exactly why. I just sat down with them and I said, I'd love to know more about your family. Would you mind sharing with me? And so I did interviews with both of them.
What a treasure.
Wrote it down. Then, I was in college, right? So I had to focus on my work. So I just kind of put it aside. Then fast forward to about 2005, I had my daughter about a year before that and had come across my notes from my grandmothers. And at this point, both of them were beginning to suffer the effects of Alzheimer's. So I knew I couldn't go back and ask them questions. So that's when I realized I need to document what they told me and write it down and make sure it's preserved. And so I started exploring and looking and became hooked. And, you know, you mentioned the aspect of cultural history. While my initial interest had been just finding the people, right, and knowing who they were.
Right, who began
As time has gone on, it's been fascinating to learn more about their lives. How did they live? What did they experience? What was going on in history around them? And I'll tell you, I didn't like history when I was growing up in school, but history is such a major component of what we do as genealogists and family historians.
Fantastic. You know,
understand the context of history. Yeah.
Fantastic. You know, I've assisted a couple friends who are Black women in trying to uncover their family trees.
Yes.
And wow, what a difficult thing to do.
It is a very different experience, right? If you're researching someone who is descended from individuals that were enslaved.
Right.
And part of the work that I do with I volunteer with the Nashville chapter of the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society.
Right.
And part of what we do as a group is really help provide resources and education and training to help individuals in that capacity. So it's, like you said, it can be difficult, but it's not impossible. It's just a different way of approaching finding the answers.
Yeah, I was able in almost all instances to get to, you know, once you get to 8 to 1940 and you get them in that census, you can usually go back, you know, to 1870 or but then there's a wall,
right?
Because the record
it's called
keeping
that brick
just
wall.
Say again,
it's called that brick wall, right?
That brick wall, sure. And it's tell us a little bit more about what the tips and techniques might be to bridge that.
Yes. So when we refer to this concept of the brick wall, that's used because 1870 was the first census where individuals who had been formerly enslaved were enumerated specifically by name systematically for the first time.
Right.
So prior to 1870, if you were African American, you were likely not listed by name in the census unless you were free. So that really limits the number of individuals that you see listed by name if you're African American in this country. But so techniques to bridge that gap, there are all kinds of ways you can do it. You can begin to explore possible families that may have owned your ancestors and research those families.
Okay.
Because individuals who were enslaved were considered property, and you keep records of your property.
Sure.
So if you can identify a slaveholding family, you would look at materials such as their wills, because you might see them name individuals that they would, you know, pass along to a family member in the case of their death. You can look in their tax records, because as property, you pay taxes on your property.
Right.
You can look in court records. There were often, you know, court cases and disputes and all kind of, you know, records created that documented the enslaved. Another great resource are the Freedmen's Bureau records. So the Freedmen's, if you're familiar with the Freedmen's.
Yes, I am. Tell our listeners what those are, though.
Yeah.
They might not be familiar.
So after emancipation, the Freedmen's Bureau, which was its common name, it had a much longer formal name, was created as an agency to help and provide assistance for individuals who were moving from enslavement to full citizenship. So they provided aid throughout the Southern United States and helped with things such as education, helped with getting labor contracts set up, having hospitals, providing rations, just a whole host of resources that the Bureau helped put in place if you'd been formerly enslaved. And so through all that, they had records. And I have found some incredible documents for some of my family members in that record collection, which a lot of it can be searched online at the website discoverfreedmen.org for free. But you can explore that if you have, if you descend from someone who was formerly enslaved, and perhaps find records for your own family. So yeah, researching the slaveholding family for wills, tax records, probate records, court records might be areas to pursue.
Tell us more about your own exploration of your family and how you went about it and maybe some interesting hurdles that you crossed.
Yeah. Well, you made a good point earlier when you said about how you can find someone in the 1940 census and then work backwards till about 1870.
Right.
And that's generally what I did. I started off with the most recent census at that time. It wasn't 1940 because that wasn't released yet, but started with the most recent census and found my family members in it. Then looked for documents like vital records, birth certificates, marriage certificates, death certificates, because they can be full of details about various family members that you can start to really put together your tree structure and find things like dates and locations that are helpful for you when you're researching,
right.
Particularly locations, because as we do genealogy and family history research, it's important to know locations because records are kept at like the county level. So starting with the census, starting with vital records, military records are another great source. Throughout World Wars One and Two, we have access to military files of the individuals who served. So you can write away for those records, and I found some interesting family history amongst some of those as well. So you work your way gradually backwards in time until you get to about 1870,
right.
And then you have to start enacting these alternative approaches.
Right.
But in my own family history, I've been able to get back, I've got ancestors, I've located one in particular who I know was born in the late 1790s.
Wow.
Because she was 90 something years old in the 1870 census. And it was just incredible to know, this is a woman who lived through slavery and several years after enslavement. So you can get back. I've located ancestors in court records while they were enslaved. I've located ancestors in the Freedmen's Bureau's records, as I was just mentioning.
So you mentioned earlier that a lot of your research has to do with North Carolina.
Yes.
So what are you doing over there? Do you travel there to do research? Or?
I have not traveled specifically for research,
right.
But I have many family members still in those areas.
Right.
So when I go home for reunions, I try to work in a visit or two to the library or to the courthouse when I can. And just being able to connect with family that still live there, so especially cemeteries. I love going to family cemeteries and taking pictures of the headstones.
I mentioned to you that my wife's family has connections in North Carolina. And
yes.
We traveled over there last fall and really had a wonderful visit.
Well, that's good. I was just talking with my stepmother just a couple of weeks ago. This is the time of year I would be traveling to North Carolina.
Right.
I tend to go in July, so it's sad that I'm not able to do that. But yes, North Carolina is home, and I really enjoy the time I get to spend when I do go home.
Super. You are involved in a number of projects here in the Nashville area. One of which, I did a podcast about a couple of years ago, and that's the Fort Negley project.
Yes.
And I know that there, from a family history standpoint, there is a Fort Negley descendants project. Can you tell us about that, what you're doing?
Absolutely.
And what that project is all about?
Yes. So the Fort Negley descendants project has been, oh goodness, such a rewarding project to be, a part of. So it's spearheaded by Dr. Angela Sutton at Vanderbilt. And the idea is that they really wanted to start to make connections and be able to identify descendants of individuals who sacrificed and helped build the fort so that those stories could be told. And so Dr. Sutton and her colleagues have been locating descendants and doing oral history interviews in order to have those stories shared. And so we've done some collaboration as we've tried to find ways to help with that work, right? To help identify descendants, help do research to map out their family trees. I was even invited to do a couple of educational videos to help train others on how you research your family tree. And it's incredible work that they're doing. It's important that the story gets told. The whole the whole way that individuals were just, you know, inscripted to go work at the fort and, you know, having to make the sacrifices they did.
Tell us more about that. What do you mean exactly?
So they were forcibly taken, or, you know, to go work at the fort, or told that if you would work at the fort, you would earn your freedom. But that was not the case. So the fort was built with labor of individuals who were in vulnerable positions, right? Because right. here, you know, they were told one thing or taken to go work there and not able to have the freedom that they thought they might get. But, and so it's important to be able to share that and tell that story.
There were many Black folk during that time who used that fort, I guess, once it was built or even under construction, as a refuge place,
yes.
As a safe place. They may have escaped a slave condition somewhere else in the South, and they came yes. here to get the protection of the Union
Army. To get
the
protection, right. So it has such a significant role in history. And, you know, it is now a site on the UNESCO Slave Heritage Trail. So, you know, it's been realized and it's been recognized for the role that it's played. So that's wonderful.
Is there, for lack of a better word, a list of the individuals who had that connection to that site that is available for people to see?
Oh yeah, that's a great question. Yes, so there is somewhat of a list.
Okay.
So the Tennessee State Library and Archives does have on their website a list of employment roles and non-payment roles. So on this list are individuals who are documented as having been paid or not paid for their services to help build the fort. Now, you know, it's not an entire list of everyone, but it's a nice list, and
yeah.
it could be a starting point if
sure.
you are thinking you might have family ties to the fort. And because you look at the list and you see surnames that are common throughout the Middle Tennessee area, right? So it's a starting place. And it's where, you know, where we start when we're trying to identify descendants, looking at the names listed on the individuals listed on these walls and seeing if we can find them in public, in records from the time.
So if a listener wanted to pursue those questions, where yes. would they contact? Who would they contact?
So yeah, you can Google Fort Negley Descendants Project and you'll be taken
okay.
right
okay.
to the website at Vanderbilt, and you'll be able to contact the team. And they would love to discuss with you. I'm pretty sure I don't want to speak for them, but I'm pretty yeah. sure they would love to hear from anyone who suspects they may have family ties to working at the fort.
I have a young Black woman I've worked with on her tree,
mm-hmm.
and one of her descendants was a brick mason and lived over there after the war, lived over there on Chestnut Street, which is
okay.
right next to the
right next to it. Yeah.
And I just lost your picture. I don't know why I lost your picture. There you go. You're still back.
Okay. Sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're doing a Zoom conference here, and we have technical weirdness going on sometimes, but we're fine. Yeah, her family lived over in that Fort Negley area after the war and are, in fact, buried
mm-hmm.
pretty close to there. I guess is it Mount Greenwood or just Greenwood Cemetery?
Greenwood Cemetery.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And I saw online that you were recently involved in documentation of that cemetery. Tell us about
yes.
that.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. That's been a
tell us
a
about that cemetery, first of
yes.
all.
Yes. Okay, yes. So yeah. let me tell you about the cemetery. So Greenwood Cemetery is the largest historic African-American cemetery in Nashville. And it was started by Preston Taylor, who had been a very prominent community member in the African-American community, was a reverend and an undertaker. And started the grounds for the cemetery. And current day, there are three locations. There is the historic Mount Ararat, which is where it started. Then next to Mount Ararat, and Mount Ararat is right behind. If anyone's in Nashville listening, it's the Purity Ice Cream.
That's over there by Trevecca Nazarene Purity, College.
Yeah. Trevecca right. Nazarene behind Purity. Mm-hmm. So that's where the original cemetery is, Mount Ararat. Then there's Greenwood Cemetery right next to it. It's Greenwood West is right next to Mount Ararat. And then further okay. down is the Greenwood Cemetery. So there's actually three cemeteries that are historic African-American cemeteries. What I have been volunteering to do is help take pictures of headstones in the cemetery, because there are so many individuals that might have family buried there that are not able to travel here to come visit their family's grave sites. And there can be often information on the headstones that can help put together some clues on your family tree. So as a volunteer who goes to take pictures of headstones, individuals from out of town can leverage and take advantage of what we're able to provide by capturing the pictures. So I volunteer specifically for a site called Billion Graves, which I go into a cemetery with my cell phone, take a picture, upload it to the site. And what's unique about Billion Graves is it captures the GPS coordinates. Right. So it helps you find the person within the cemetery geographically, because it's a pretty large cemetery. So if all you knew is someone is buried there, you may not know where they are.
Right.
But through Billion Graves, it allows you to really pinpoint their exact location in the cemetery.
Yeah, otherwise so, it'd take you a whole day to just
just to walk around the whole cemetery looking for a plot.
Sure. So in I've seen Billion Graves as something that's searchable. When I go onto my Ancestry account, I can find records in that database on Ancestry, I believe.
So you can find records for Find a Grave on Ancestry, okay. Which is a different website.
Right.
It's been around longer than Billion Graves. Find a Grave has been around for over 20 years, and Find a Grave is actually owned by Ancestry. So yes, you can search the records of Find a Grave through Ancestry. Billion Graves are searchable through the FamilySearch.org website.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a good point, because I get on FamilySearch frequently also. And I know that you're, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds with all the different services.
Yeah.
But I'll ask it in the form of a question. Is FamilySearch where you keep your fundamental records?
It's a place where I share the information that I've learned.
Okay.
It's not the primary place where I keep my records, but their model is really one that encourages sharing. And I like to share. Okay. And so I do use it for that point.
Now, FamilySearch, for our listeners to know, is organized in a product of the Church of Latter-day Saints. It's a remarkable, and it's a free site.
It's
a remarkable source of records. And it also, there's an opportunity there for you to actually keep a tree on that site. It becomes a public tree, but it's a great mechanism to explore their records and to keep their records organized. What do you, as a genealogist, what do you use for your record collection?
For my primary record keeping, I use a program on my local computer,
right?
And then I share it multiple places online.
Right. So do you? I use Family Tree Maker, which I keep on my computer. Is there a particular program that you use?
I use Roots Magic.
Roots Magic.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So we have so many options available to us, right? As researchers. Right. So I use Roots Magic, and like you, I share it to Ancestry, and it allows me to share to FamilySearch.
You know, you. I noticed on your bio that you work on several projects involving the U.S. GenWeb.
Yes.
Now, it's so fascinating because when, you know, I was involved in genealogy at the inception of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, I had been involved in the analog world for years before there was a thing called the internet.
Yes.
And, you know, I used to go to the library and go through the microfilms and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But now the internet came on board, and one of the very first things that happened was the GenWeb project. Tell us about that and about your involvement in it.
Yes. So like you noted, right when the internet launched, so around 1996, if I've got my timeline correct, the U.S. GenWeb project was created. And it is a network of websites where there is a website dedicated to every county or parish in the United States. And every county has a coordinator. And that coordinator is responsible for helping post information online to help you if your family is from that county or parish. So I have been volunteering with primarily the North Carolina and Tennessee projects. I do volunteer in some other states. I have a county in Utah and Florida and Illinois.
Goodness.
And Kentucky. So, but it's been, it's such a rewarding endeavor because you're really providing resources to help individuals, and especially right when the internet was just coming up and there wasn't as much available. Right. Now that we have so much accessible, that's nice, but not everything is online. That's and right. So one of the advantages of getting in touch with your US GenWeb local coordinator for whatever county you're researching is that they are likely to be able to help you tap into those things that are not online, because they're usually coordinated by someone who's very knowledgeable about the area.
Well, tell us about your counties. Which counties are you?
So in North Carolina, I have Washington County, which is where my family's from, which is Eastern North Carolina. I have Martin County, which is also Eastern North Carolina. I have Wake County, which is the seat of Raleigh, the county, this right. capital of the state is. I also... Let's see. Oh, I have Onslow County, and I have Jones County. Also, most in Eastern North Carolina. Wow. In Tennessee, I have Shelby County, so that's Memphis. I have Madison County, so Jackson.
Sure.
And then I think those are the two counties I do for Blount. Oh, my gosh. Okay. How can I forget Blount? That was the very first county I did take on for Tennessee. So it's been I've learned so much in the process. I really have. And I'll tell you why I started volunteering. When I was getting started, I benefited from the volunteer work that others had contributed for the U.S. General Project. Yeah. And so what I wanted to give back. So that's why I became interested in becoming a volunteer.
That's just fantastic. You know, mm-hmm. there's also, just for our reader or listeners, there is an international component to
there
the
GenWeb
project. And I have in my my genealogy work tied into the Irish sites, and each of the counties in Ireland has a GenWeb coordinator also. So,
oh, that's great.
You know, and some are better than others. Some actually aren't much at all. But,
right. It will vary.
But they're certainly worth checking off the box.
Definitely.
As you're gathering information.
And like I said, even getting in touch with the coordinator, because there may be things they know that are not online.
So, Tania, you are chapter president of the African American Historical and Genealogical Society. I guess it's Middle Tennessee chapter or Nashville chapter.
Yes.
Tell us about that organization and what you're doing there.
All right. So yes, we are one of several chapters across the entire country. So we're located here in Nashville. Our chapter was started in 2005. And as a society, we are dedicated to helping not only, you know, individuals research their families of African-American origin here in the middle. We tend to focus on Middle Tennessee because we're the only chapter in this area. So Nashville and the surrounding counties, as well as helping people tell those stories. So whether you want to publish your work, we have meetings several times a year, often about once a month, except for some months throughout the year. And we have guest speakers come in and share information on various projects they're doing to help advance African-American history in Nashville and the surrounding areas. We have educational workshops. Okay. So we provide training. For example, we're about to do a workshop next month on making family history gifts. And we have a workshop we're planning on understanding how you use DNA.
Wait a second. Family history gifts. What does that mean exactly?
Oh, like various gifts.
So interesting.
Various gifts that you might be able to provide for your family that incorporate family history. So we have one of our members, she's done some very interesting project of making a quilt that represents her family history. So she's going to share some information about that. And, you know, family tree charts. And, you know, there's all kind of ways that you can share, you know, family history in tangible ways for your family that may not be as obsessed about genealogy as you are, right? But would like to hear those stories. And so, so that's what we do as a society. And we also help with various projects. Like that's how we got involved with helping with the Fort Negley Descendants Project. So helping to provide information, resources, education to help individuals who are researching their families.
Now, where would someone find information about that organization and
you can find us. Yes, you can find us online on our website. Okay. It's our acronym is AAHGS, A-A-H-G-S. And so we are at AAHGSNashville.org.
Okay. All right. And does that group have a Facebook presence?
We do. You okay. can type in AAHGS Nashville and find our Facebook page.
All right. Super. And I presume that when you have an event or
we do share it there. Yes, okay. we do share our events on our Facebook page and our website.
So, what's the future got going for you?
Oh man, it's been so exciting. So I am currently focused on an initiative that I've started that I call the Academy of Legacy Leaders. And I run a Facebook community of individuals vested and passionate about family history. And we have discussions about the various ways you can build, save, share, organize your family history, whether it's through doing genealogy research, whether it's through a love of photos and telling and capturing the stories behind those photos, or through storytelling. Because, you know, not everyone does genealogy research, but many people are just interested in those family stories. And so I've had a great time interacting with the community that I call legacy leaders on finding ways for us to do more of that, and also providing educational webinars and courses around those topics.
Super. Tania, let me ask you this question. I have done the ancestry family tree DNA testing.
Yes.
For myself. Yes. My wife has done it for her family, and it has allowed me to learn of a lot of cousins that I never knew of.
That will certainly happen.
it also permitted me to fill in blank places on my tree that otherwise would never have found.
Yes.
Information about my great great grandmother was named Ayers, and I suspected, but I couldn't prove that she was connected to a larger Ayers family in the Wilkes-Barre Scranton area. Mm-hmm. But through DNA, I've been able to establish that there was
a connection. Okay, you were able to confirm that.
Have you done that? Is that something that folks interested in African-American genealogy can benefit from?
Oh, yes. So I have done it. I have had my DNA tested at multiple companies, as well as many individuals in my family. And yes, there definitely is a benefit, particularly if you're of African American ancestry, because as you noted, you will find cousins that you are connected to that you may not have known. And one thing that happens for African Americans is on average, about 20% of the DNA of an African American person is of European origin, and you will connect to cousins that are of European descent.
Sure.
And so you might be able to associate where that shared ancestry comes from, and maybe commit confirmation of who you suspect might be, the white individual in your family tree.
Right.
And so it can be helpful for solving some of those answering some of those questions. Yes.
What about taking your Black origins across the water to Africa?
There's that as well. So when you take a DNA test from one of the companies, they will give you an insight into which countries in Africa you have shared ancestry with.
Right.
Now, of course, there are migration patterns that happen across the continent, and they're comparing you against current day populations in those countries. So it gives you a feeling, it gives you insight.
Right.
You also just need to be cognizant of the limitations around that as well.
Right.
But it can give you insight. Like, I've got Nigerian in mind. No surprises, come from West Africa, because that's where the slave trade, primarily came through as they brought slaves over to this country. But a lot of people do take the test to get insight into what countries in Africa their family may have been from. So, and then they take trips back, right, to these countries and get to experience that culture firsthand. That's something my husband is very much wanting to do. He wants to travel over to Western Africa. So,
well, I certainly would encourage you to do that.
Yes.
I've traveled to Germany and to Ireland, and knowing family history makes the trip a lot more meaningful.
Yeah. You know, what's been interesting is we talked about Family Search earlier. Family Search has been doing a very large initiative to capture the oral stories from the griots in those African countries. And so they're capturing this and recording griots telling centuries of family history.
Okay. So, you're using a term that I'm not
griot.
Familiar with.
Ah, griot. Okay. So we talked about roots a little bit earlier.
Sure.
And in the book, and in the story, in the show, towards the end, it's recounted how Alex Haley travels to Western Africa and is told a story of an elder in the village who is recounting the generations back. Well, that's all oral history. Okay. So a griot is a person who learns through their ancestors, so it's passed down from generation to generation, the ability to tell a multi-generational historical story of the family tree and the people in the family. And so a person who's a griot has, yes, G-R-I-O-T.
Okay.
So it's a person who's able to recount hundreds of years of oral history of the families. And so they memorize it. It's not usually written down. It's just all spoken orally.
Okay.
And so Family Search has been recording them.
Oh, my.
so that can be captured. And that's an amazing project to think about, right? To be able to document hundreds of years of family history that's usually only spoken.
So they're going over to Africa to do this.
Yes, they are.
Man, that's just fantastic.
Yes. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, speaking of the DNA thing, you know, Henry Gates has talked several times in his show when they get to the DNA discussion with each of his guests. Mm-hmm. Particularly when he is an African American guest, about the myth that African Americans, many are related to Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Right? Did you find any of that in your DNA?
Not in my tree.
Okay.
But I am very familiar with individuals who are told they have Native American ancestry, even as close as maybe a great-grandparent, and a DNA test reveals, no, that's not the case.
Right.
Especially if you're told it's a great-grandparent,
right,
and you're not seeing that, because the amount of DNA you would expect to see is not there.
Exactly. Okay. No. Well, that's just kind of a fun thing. It's
interesting, right? Because it's one way to, okay, I'll just say yes. It happens that you may have an oral history, and it turns out that the DNA doesn't confirm it, although the DNA cannot always confirm it.
Sure.
So it's a matter of looking at much broader than just the DNA, but there are some cases where the DNA should be able to confirm it if it's there.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well, Tanea, you have been such a joy to speak with, and I thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, and, thank you.
Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, and I would encourage your listeners, if y'all have any questions at all, please feel free to reach out to me. You can find me on, you know, Google. You can type my name in, Google me. On Facebook, look for Academy of Legacy Leaders and join the community, and we're glad to have you on board.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.